From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Yes, the which came first debate, chicken or egg, is still raging. But what comes after that? Well, the farm egg. While egg whites were the heroes of the early aughts, the pendulum has swung back and healthy fats are once again in fashion. Now that eggs seem to be permissible as part of a well-rounded diet, it's all about the color of the yolks. Writer Marion Bull ponders why orange is the new yolk. Hi, Marion.
Hi, Evan. So great to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. I have opinions.
I can't wait to hear them.
What has been America's relationship with the egg yolk?
Well, you know, it's changed a lot over the last, let's say, 70 years. Thanks to some potentially misleading scientific studies in the 1950s, there was a big fear of dietary cholesterol in the second half of the 20th century in the U.S. Many of us who were alive and eating in the 90s are familiar with the egg white omelet, or maybe the, you know, carton of egg whites that you or your mom might have had in the fridge at any point between, let's say, 1980 and 2000, whatever. But given the interest that has developed in American eaters and diners and cooks in the last 20 years in, you know, finding more locally sourced ingredients and quote unquote natural ingredients, we've become really excited about eggs, about putting eggs on non-breakfast foods. And as we've kind of become obsessed with humane farming practices and locally sourced food, the egg yolk has kind of become this like icon of virtue, regardless of how it's reached our plates.
When did the virtues of a really jammy orange yolk move from the restaurant to the home kitchen?
I think that's a really good question. So the egg kind of entered fine dining or more casual fine dining restaurants in the mid to late 2000s, in part because of the popularity of Dave Chang's Momofuku in New York, but also thanks to the recession, which, you know, was a time when fine dining chefs were kind of finding ways to serve cheaper ingredients in fancier ways. I think that in the mid-2000s, and especially in 2020, when so many people were stuck inside cooking and watching food videos and all of this, I think that the egg, especially the kind of like jammy soft-boiled egg, which was definitely popularized by Bon Appetit, there was a spread in the magazine in the mid-2010s that was the first mention there of the, you know, jammy seven-minute egg. It became this sort of affordable luxury, right? You know, most people can cook an egg, but to get that very specific, jammy, not undercooked, not hard-boiled yolk, it does take a certain level of finesse. So it's super accessible, but it's still something that you can kind of fuss over. Everyone has their own way of doing it. Some people will boil the egg and then put it in ice water. Some people won't. And then, of course, there was the whole sous vide boom of, you know, the late 2000s, early 2010s. And so I think that, you know, it's very familiar, but especially now that we're getting these much more orange yolks on our eggs, it's a way for people to kind of feel like they're having this little luxurious and very photogenic garnish on top of maybe just a plain bowl of pasta or a plain bowl of rice.
So let's talk about those seductive orange yolks. Do they occur naturally?
So sometimes they do. There are certain breeds of heritage birds that do produce a darker yolk, particularly the Copper Morans hen, which has long been prized, particularly in France, I believe, for, you know, its rich flavor, its richly colored yolk, and even the egg itself is sort of a copper color, hence the name Copper Morans.
And in the U.S., are they associated with a particular brand?
No, I mean, there are some brands that claim that some of their farms do raise Copper Morans hens. And obviously there are, you know, small farms that raise them. But as far as brands that you can find in the grocery store, I think maybe one or two of them. But the thing about this kind of heritage breed hen is that they don't lay as many eggs as the kind of run-of-the-mill industrial hen that, you know, these more high production producers are using. So it's actually a less economically viable hen for a farmer to buy.
So what are farms doing to get that yolk and seduce customers? Are they doing some kind of special feed supplementation?
Yeah, there are a number of things that you can add to a chicken's feed to change the color of the yolk, particularly marigold and turmeric, I think, are two of the most popular options, which obviously are natural ingredients and they don't really affect the flavor of the egg. So there's nothing wrong with supplementing a chicken's feed with that. There's definitely something to be said for eating something that's beautiful, but there is this obfuscation of how those eggs are coming to look that way.
Yes, I understand that there's like a chart, sort of like a paint palette that farmers can get and decide on what exact color of yellow to orange they want and how to go about getting that.
Yeah, it's called the yolk fan. And what's really interesting is that I think in different countries and across different cultures, the color of the yolk means something different. So what I've heard is that in England, you know, their version of the kind of cheap diner egg that we have here is a super orange egg, whereas our cheap diner egg is like a pale yellow. So it is very easy for farmers, regardless of the living conditions of their chickens, regardless of the breed of their chickens, to achieve a wide variety of colors in the yolk, you know, from pale yellow to a deep, deep dark orange.
You know, as a person who has spent a lot of time in Europe, I'm really familiar with picking up a carton of eggs that is really deeply orange, has deeply orange yolks. But I had an experience here in LA recently that really made me think. I went to a restaurant that is known for making an absolutely delicious and perfect omelet. I was so jonesing on this omelet, and which I'd had many, 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 many times before. And it was served to me and it was orange. I mean, orange. There was no yellow. And I started to eat it and then felt I couldn't eat it. I ended up leaving because it so disturbed me. And I've thought about that so much since that's happened.
It's funny how a slight change in that color gradation can really affect your experience of what you're eating. So I wrote this piece for Eater about, you know, the rise of the orange egg yolk. And the reason that I got this idea was that my boyfriend bought a dozen of these eggs and made scrambled eggs for us. And they were like, they almost looked radioactive. They were so orange and I was so... They tasted completely fine. They tasted delicious. They tasted like scrambled eggs. But I was really put off by them. And I actually spoke to Susan Spungen, who's a food stylist for the piece. And she said that, you know, she likes to buy these orange yolked eggs for photo shoots because they are so visually striking. But one time she tried to make pâté sucré with them and she couldn't use it for the job because it looked like it had been artificially dyed. You know, it was like if you rolled out your pie crust and it was orange.
Yeah, it's just so interesting how it, like in a pasta, it would read perfect. It would read, oh, rich, homemade, delicious. But in a different setting, it's just, I mean, for me at least, I had the exact same experience you did.
As they say, we eat with our eyes, right? But that also means that we can kind of be grossed out by our eyes if it goes a little too far.
Are we also linking this color to like a virtuousness, a sort of super all-natural experience?
I absolutely think so. Let's say you go to Whole Foods, or let's say you go to kind of an upscale grocer where they have a lot of different kinds of eggs that you can buy. If you scan the different labels, you will notice that these labels are trying to make you think that these chickens are just living in the lap of luxury. They have acres and acres of land available to them. They have the world's most orange yolks. And there's a lot of virtue signaling in the copy and the copywriting on these labels. And it can make it really confusing as a consumer, as somebody who's shopping and wants to, you know, buy yourself a dozen eggs that hopefully don't make you feel bad about yourself. But I think that the orange yolk has definitely become kind of a signifier of virtue, of animal welfare, of quote-unquote natural products. And I think that can also lead to, you know, companies sort of taking advantage of that.
You know, I really love when we get to nerd out in a segment. So thank you for going along on this orange yolk ride with us.
It's truly my pleasure. It's truly my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was writer, potter, and editor Marian Bull. We've been discussing the newish obsession with orange egg yolks. To read her piece for Eater, head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood, for the link. Coming up, Chef Ludo Lefebvre explains how to make the perfect omelet. Welcome back to Good Food. Chef Ludo Lefebvre is known as many things, as the chef and owner of the restaurants Petit Trois and the now closed Trois Mec, as a television personality, and as a man who makes a perfect, perhaps life-changing omelet. His version, made with Bersin cheese and a few chives, has been his favorite since childhood. Oh, it's so great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I've been really lucky, and I've gotten to have eggs that you've cooked a few times, once scrambled that I'll never forget with uni, and the omelet that you're serving now at Petit Trois. So take me through the ingredients. What do you start with?
So, sure. Bon, I start with a non-stick pan.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. So you're not into copper or traditional French pan, black steel?
No, just a non-stick pan. Then a little rubber spatula. And the ingredients, so of course, very, very good eggs, good butter, salt, chive, and that's it. That's the omelette. Then after, you can add cheese if you want or some garnish. But I prefer just eggs, salt, herbs, and a little touch of cheese too. Like at Petit Trois, we use boursin. With boursin, I would call it like the French Velveeta. Because everybody in France have boursin in their fridge. And, you know, it's a very cheap cheese and it's good. Everybody love it.
Okay, so take us through the process from beginning to end. First of all, the eggs. The eggs should be very fresh.
Very fresh. We get our eggs in the farmer's market. Crack the eggs in the mixing bowl. Mix them very, very, very energetic.
Energetically.
Energetic, you know. Beat them very well. You know, you make sure the egg yolk and the egg white are mixed very well. Sometimes people do a mistake and don't mix enough. And then you see some little piece of egg white in your omelette. So make sure it's really, you mix them, you beat them a lot. Like at least for good 2 or 3 minutes.
Do you do it with a fork or with a whisk?
I do a whisk. But I remember who's giving me a hard time at the restaurant. Anthony Bourdain came to the restaurant and see me beating an omelette with a whisk. Oh, Jacques Pépin, you know, don't use a whisk, Ludo. Jacques Pépin, use a fork.
And Jacques Pépin is the most viewed example of making an omelette on the internet.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. No, seriously?
Yeah.
Amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So anyway, so beat your eggs very well, seasoning a little your eggs with kosher salt and white pepper. And
why white pepper?
I never really like your black pepper. I don't know. For me, black pepper is too strong, and you see them in the eggs. I don't like it.
Your white pepper, is it fresh ground?
Yeah, fresh ground, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, beat the eggs, kosher salt, white pepper, fresh ground. Then after, melt a little piece of butter in a non-stick pan. I would say take like an 8-inch or 9-inch non-stick pan.
And how many?
Three eggs. Then, melt your butter slowly. No coloration. Okay, I want your butter to sizzling, but no coloration. You know, don't make a brown butter. Your butter should be gentle, like melting slowly. An omelette is the way to cook it, is to need to be gentle. And then, add your eggs, and then just with the spatula, just scramble them. Imagine you scramble eggs with a whisk. Do the same thing with the spatula. You almost do like you start from the middle and go around. How you say?
You're almost going around like in a spiral.
Voilà, exactly. You do that. You start the middle, you mix, and go all around until the border and putting back the eggs in the middle. And you do that for at least 2 or 3 minutes. Then your eggs are going to start to set up. So when you see your eggs to set up, you stop on the side of the burner. And then after you have your Boursin cheese, put a lot of Boursin cheese. I mean, I would say for 3 eggs, put at least a good 2 ounces of Boursin cheese in your omelette. Then put it back in on the top of the burner. Let's set for 1 minute. And then we're going to start the process to rouler the omelette.
Before we roule the omelette, describe what the surface looks like. Is it wet?
It's a little wet. The eggs are cooked, but it's a little bit wet. A little bit, you know. It's not very cooked through.
So it's glistening.
Glistening, well, exactly. It's like glistening. It's like almost like when you see the ocean, you know, like when it's flat. Very nice, very shiny, and the eggs are cooked. And then you're going to start the process to folding, rouler your omelette. You're going to take your omelette in your hand and lift a little your omelette.
The pan.
The pan. And then with the spatula, you are going to take the top of the omelette and start the folding with the spatula, slowly. But you put too little bit touch of butter.
Oh.
You know, this will make your omelette a little shiny. And it'll be more easy for the omelette to not be stick in the non-stick pan to help the folding, the butter, definitely. And I flip it over into the plate. And after you add a little touch of fleur de sel, chopped chive, and voilà.
It's the most incredible combination, that simple omelette with this Dijon dressed
with shallot.
Salad. Yes.
Dijon mustard, white wine vinegar, chopped shallot, and I use canola oil.
Now, some people might say, oh, you're putting a salad on the side of the omelette for breakfast?
Yeah.
So is breakfast when you would typically eat an omelette, or would you eat it another part of the day?
No. In France, we don't really eat an omelette for breakfast. We eat more an omelette maybe for lunch or more the night. Most of the time, I always remember my grandma always was doing an omelette most of the time when she have nothing in the fridge. Because in France, we always have eggs in the fridge. So scrambled eggs, omelette, and cheese and herbs. That's it. So in France, it was more like the night.
Are you having fun with Petit Trois, being able to serve this kind of food?
Yeah, I'm very happy at Petit Trois, you know, to really serve some very, very classic French dish, like a steak frites, omelette. We have steak tartare. Now we're working on choucroute for the winter, on cassoulet. Very classic, you know. Most of the time I'm known for being more like a more high-end chef, you know, more frou-frou restaurant a little bit, I will say. But I'm so happy to create this little Petit Trois. People really feel like they're in France. It's tiny. Yeah, you're going to touch your neighbor, but that's the way it is in Paris, no little wine bar.
The last time I was there, actually, the neighbors that were eating to the side of me, we shared our food.
See, that's so cool. You know, Evan, that's exactly what I want to create in Petit Trois. I want the food bring people together. And for me, that's very important to create a art of living in this restaurant. It's where we create life, where life happening. My inspiration for this place come from a restaurant in Paris in the 6th arrondissement called L'Avant Comptoir. It's a tiny little restaurant. You have 2 cook and they just do everything. Serving your wine, your cocktail, and people sharing plate, it's small plate. I just love this ambiance. I love it.
Thank you so much, Ludo.
Merci, Evan. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
That was Chef Ludo Lefebvre discussing his omelette-making technique. Trading in a life on Wall Street, Lisa Steele gave into her DNA as a fifth-generation chicken keeper. She founded the blog Fresh Eggs Daily, which has been viewed more than 50 million times. With Easter just around the corner, we thought it was a perfect time to catch up with her. She joins us from her home in Maine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do you have snow out the view of your window?
We have a little bit under the trees and where the sun didn't shine, but we had a lot of melting the last couple days.
Oh, good. over a cranberry and orange muffin and a sip of coffee was when you decided to shut your briefcase and get off Wall Street. Why did you decide to return to chickens, especially since some of your early memories weren't so positive?
I think that in life, you end up exactly where you belong. And I think if you signs and listen to your heart and listen to your gut, I think it's something that I couldn't have avoided because I just, this is where I belong. I took a kind of a long route to get back here. And it's true, I didn't have the greatest chicken experiences as a kid, but I really love what I'm doing now. And I know it was meant to be.
You've written 6 books on raising chickens.
Yeah.
So before we get into their product, the egg, is there anything in particular you'd like to warn urbanites or share for those who are thinking about jumping into keeping chickens in the city?
I could talk for hours about chickens, but in a nutshell, do some research, check your local laws to make sure that you know how many chickens you can have, if you need permits, things like that. And then just do some basic reading, figure out so you know the foundation, the basics, what you need to feed your chickens, how to keep them safe. Don't eat them because that's a huge problem. But other than that, they're pretty easy once you get your whole setup in place. And I highly recommend it. It's just a really fun thing to do.
You must have, eggs constantly around you. Are eggs something that your family eats every single day?
Pretty much. I mean, there are times of year when the chickens aren't laying, like in the winter, unless you have new baby chicks that just started laying. But yeah, pretty much, I have a drawer in the fridge just dedicated to eggs, and that's pretty much where I go. But I think almost every meal I'm reaching for at least an egg for something.
It makes us feel better to hear that, I have to tell you, for those of us who are in love with eggs. What are some common mistakes that people make when they cook eggs?
I think the biggest mistake, too fast. Eggs cook super fast anyway, so you want to do it over low heat, and especially when you're scrambling eggs, whisk them and get them all mixed up before you even put them in the pan, because if you crack a couple eggs in the pan and then start whisking them up, you're going to end up with those clumps of egg white because they've cooked fast. Get them whisked in and incorporated.
When you scramble eggs, do you add anything to the mixture? Do you add water or cream or milk?
I don't. I know that people like to. I think that it makes the eggs watery. And I think if you have a good fresh egg, it's going to taste delicious without anything. And there's going to be enough moisture in that egg that the egg's not going to dry out. Sometimes I don't even add salt or pepper. I just will scramble eggs and a little bit of butter and call it a day.
Sounds good. It's funny how something that simple can just get your juices flowing. How can we tell if eggs that we have in the house are fresh?
You can't tell just by looking at an egg, unfortunately. But the float test, which people who raise chickens are probably very familiar with, you fill a glass with water and gently drop your egg in. And if the egg sits on the bottom, it's super fresh. Starting to rise up a little bit on one end, it's starting to get a little old. And if the egg floats, it's really, really old, could possibly be bad. As an egg ages, air gets in through the pores in the eggshell, so the egg starts to get buoyant. So that's kind of a good gauge. By 2 or 3 weeks or so, one end of that egg is probably up off the bottom of the glass.
And what happens if we cook old eggs?
Nothing. They probably still have about the same nutrition. I've read that eggs don't really lose a lot of nutrition as they age, but you're going to lose some of the texture because the egg has texture. The white is going to be runny. A lot of the protein bonds break down. So if you crack an old egg into a frying pan, for example, it's just going to spread all over the place. It's not going to stay in one place like it should.
Since your life is so egg-focused, I'm curious about what happens when Easter rolls around. Is there a huge dyeing gathering, a hunt? And what's always on the table on the day?
It's really funny because I grew up with chickens also, and I never remember looking for real eggs. We used those little plastic eggs that you could put something inside. Even as a kid, we never actually hunted for real eggs, which is pretty funny. We did dye them, but I do actually like dyeing eggs. I don't think that it necessarily has to be something that just kids do. And I love using vegetable dyes, so like beet greens or spinach, turmeric, blueberry, things you can make natural dyes with, and the eggs come out really pretty.
You know, you have a recipe for turmeric deviled eggs that looks like the perfect thing for an Easter brunch.
I love that recipe. That came about because I wanted to include a pickled egg recipe in the cookbook. And a lot of the recipes, I don't love the red pickled egg look. And then I found a recipe that used the turmeric, so they turned out yellow instead. And I thought, how cool would that be to basically pickle your eggs in a turmeric solution so the outside of the egg white turns yellow, but then turn them into deviled eggs? And I just love that. I think if you brought that for Easter, people would absolutely adore it.
And I know that you have a bread that you make that has an Easter variation.
Yes, and I'm so sad that that photo didn't get into the cookbook. You know, you can't have a photo for every recipe, but Finnish pula bread, which is like a challah or, you know, a braided bread that my family makes for Easter, you know, when I was young, and then now I do as well to carry on the tradition. But you can also tuck some eggs into the braid and then bake it like that, raw eggs, so then the eggs cook as the bread is baking. Also really pretty for your Easter table. And using the plant dyes obviously is safer, you know, because you're not using food coloring and it's not getting into your bread.
It would also be pretty to just use naturally colored eggs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If you have chickens that lay green or blue eggs, that's what I usually do because we do have the different colored eggs.
What's your absolute favorite way to prepare eggs?
The cover should be a hint, although it was completely coincidental. But if I could only eat eggs one way for the rest of my life, it would absolutely be Eggs Benedict.
Well, I know what I'm going to have to be in search of soon. Thank you so much. It's a marvelous book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's Lisa Steele, known as the Queen of the Coop. We've been discussing all the uses for the incredible edible egg. Want a link to her recipe for deviled eggs with turmeric? Just at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. You'll find more recipes in her book, The Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook. In a minute, we hear about the challenges and heartbreaks of raising backyard chickens. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. For those of us who eat meat, chicken is easy to dismiss as just another dinner ingredient. The 26 billion chickens living on industrial farms might feel differently about that. There is another way. Raising your own chickens. It was once really common in the U.S., but the practice declined. Until recently, that is. Raising backyard chickens can even be a status symbol. Journalist Tova Danovich describes her fowl journey to becoming a backyard chicken farmer in her book, Under the Henfluence. Hi, Tova.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, well, we loved your book. You write, "Today, there's never been a worse time to be a chicken." What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the chicken of the 21st century, I mean, the bird itself, as well as how it's raised, is so different from even 60 years ago, certainly from 100 years ago. When my grandmother was a little girl, you know, chickens were in backyards. People raised them in small flocks. They had access to the outdoors. Many breeds of chicken then were still what's considered dual purpose. So they were raised for both eggs and meat. And you would have the same chicken, you know, lay eggs until she gets too old and then she becomes dinner. That all started to change around World War II. The change had been in place for a little while, but it really started to get codified that we moved our chickens inside to these giant farms where increasingly, like so many things in modern America, the birds were expected to specialize. So now we have these dual tracks almost of birds where we have the egg-laying hens who have gone from laying about 150 eggs a year in 1947 to now close to 300 a year today. And because of that, they're not much good for meat. So we have this other type of chicken, the broiler chicken, who gets to be their 6-pound slaughter weight in roughly 6 weeks. And they are then killed to become, you know, rotisserie chickens for people all around the world.
Raising chickens runs in your family. Tell us about your great-grandmother and how she got into the business while living on a farm in North Dakota.
My great-grandmother, like I think a lot of farm women from the early 1900s, found her way into the chicken business, kind of whether she wanted to or not. She was gifted as a wedding gift from her new husband, a coop and as many chickens as she could raise. And she was given that so that she could use the money she got from those hens' eggs, the meat eventually, and that paid for the household expenses. This was so common that a lot of people refer to this as egg money. And a lot of people think that this egg money was just, you know, to pay for nice jewelry, for getting your hair done, but that wasn't the case at all. Egg money was actually a huge contributor to a lot of families. In my grandma's case, you know, it paid for school books, clothing. In many families, it paid for food. Essentially everything except for the farm itself was paid for by these women and their small flocks of backyard chickens.
So raising chickens comes back into vogue. And I have a sense of when this was because I was alive and working and focusing on food. But tell us when it started to happen and what you think led to it.
I also noticed it in kind of the early 2000s. It started growing again. Of course, some people have kept chickens in their backyards this whole time. Certainly people in more rural areas, that hasn't gone away. But around the 2005 or so, we started getting a lot of these food books like Fast Food Nation or The Omnivore's Dilemma that looked at what was happening in our industrial food system and questioned if there could be a better way. So I would peg the return of backyard chickens to roughly 2005 to 2010 or so. But it's kept growing since then. And we've had waves of people getting into chickens again. We saw it certainly with the early lockdown in 2020, where hatcheries were actually sold out of many breeds of chicks because so many people were stuck at home and decided it was a great time to put a coop in the backyard.
When you finally got your first batch of chicks, you and your husband were living in a house with a yard in Portland, Oregon. How many did you get? What breed did you initially decide upon? And did you name them?
So we got three initially, which seemed like a very practical number for a two-person household in terms of the egg production. And we did name them. I had Joan, who is a Dominique, which is a black and white barred breed, but the first recognized chicken breed in America, which I thought was a fun bit of history to have for my first flock. I had Betty, who is a frost white leg bar, and she would have laid beautiful sky blue eggs. So she was my first entree into the world of rainbow egg baskets. And then I had Peggy, who is an olive egger, which is a mutt breed. And they are known for laying beautiful olive green eggs, which she's 5 now, and she still lays just giant, extra large green eggs that are just gorgeous.
Wow. That's so amazing. And they're all different and beautiful too, right? Their feather patterns
and their personalities are different too, which is I think a thing people don't really expect when they go into chicken raising. I now have 8 8 hens, and they're mostly different breeds. They're all different colors and sizes. And I can actually tell who's talking to me because their voices and the sounds they make are different. And some of them are a little friendlier and like to come up and give me a peck and see what I'm doing. And others like to always be at arm's length unless there are treats involved.
Wow. So raising chickens, it may sound quite charming and they look unbelievably cute in photos, but you faced some serious challenges. Tell us about some of those.
One of my first challenges came, unfortunately, pretty early on, and that was when Betty, who was one of these first chicks I had, was killed by my beloved dog, who I'd had as a puppy. We had tried really hard to see if we could get the two species to get along, and our dog just had too high of a prey drive, and they're not allowed outside at the same time anymore, and everything has been fine since. But one of the hardest things about chickens is that they die. They can live quite a long time. I think currently our longest lived chicken is 20 or 21 years old, but many more of them live only about 5 to 10 years.
What about their safety? It seems like they'd be easy pickings for coyotes or other animals looking for a tasty meal.
Definitely. And my first bit of advice I always give to people who ask me, what are your top tips if you're looking into getting backyard chickens, is have a good predator-proof coop, because it can really make or break your chicken keeping experience. A lot of these pre-made coops that they sell online are quite small and made out of, you know, essentially balsa wood. And just about anything that wants to get in, from a dog to a raccoon to a bear. Certainly people in Alaska have to bear-proof their coops, which I'm not jealous of, will rip right through it. So I definitely recommend people either find someone local who can make a coop or make one themselves, because a lot of what you can't buy, just you're not going to be happy with it, and you don't want disaster to strike.
You write, looking at my hands, all distant relatives of the Tyrannosaurus rex, it's easy to see the predator's gaze in their eyes. What did you learn about chicken behavior and psychology from this experience?
Well, I won't make people read the whole book during this interview, because I learned so much about them. They make, you know, at least 24 or so different noises that all correspond to specific things. They have an alarm call for predators on the ground versus predators in the sky. And when a hen has baby chicks, she'll make an alarm sound for a small hawk, which usually she wouldn't bother warning anyone about at all, because she knows that that hawk is a danger to her babies. These are behaviors that we usually think of in more intelligent, quote unquote, animals, and not something like a chicken. But like a lot of species, you know, the more we look at them, the smarter we discover that they are.
So I have to ask, have any of your birds ever become Instagram influencers?
All of my birds are Instagram influencers, as it turns out. When I first got chickens about 5 years ago, I swiftly discovered I was taking a lot of pictures of them. It was kind of clogging up my personal Instagram feed. And so I decided to start an Instagram account for these chickens. And whenever I'm in the yard with them, I'm always taking photos and videos of the cute little things that they're doing. So all of my girls, which you can find them on Instagram at Best Little Hen House, they're quite popular. They have people who know every individual chicken in my flock of 8 and, you know, remember stories from years ago now. And they have 110,000 followers, which is far more than all of my social media put together. So good job, ladies.
How fabulous. Thank you so much, Tova. It was really fun talking to you about chickens.
Yeah, thank you. I'm here to talk about chickens all day, every day.
That was journalist Tova Danovich discussing her book, Under the Henfluence, Inside the World of Backyard Chickens and the People Who Love Them. You'll find a link to it on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, we discuss the Filipino delicacy, balut. I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. Cultural identity is fascinating and complex. Food is one particularly delicious lens through which we can explore it. In her book, independent scholar and folklorist Margaret Magat looks at balut, the fertilized eggs of the Philippines, as a way of exploring culinary capital in the Filipino diaspora. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Evan.
What is a balut egg? How does it differ from our understanding of a hard-boiled egg, for example?
A balut egg is an embryonic egg or an egg that's been fertilized and allowed to progress so that it's at least 17 to 21 days old. It's usually boiled and eaten with salt or some other condiment, but it's basically a partially formed duck or chicken.
What are the components? If you were to completely open the shell, what would be inside it?
First, you would see that there's some liquid, which is basically a really tasty soup. And then there's the albumen, which is a hard part that is the white of the egg. And then there's the embryo, which has been surrounded a little bit by the yolk. And that would be a balut egg.
When is it eaten and by whom?
In Southeast Asia, a lot of people eat balut. And in the Philippines, a lot of people eat it. There's kids and parents and grandparents. Whenever you're having a social party, a drinking party called inuman, a lot of men eat it during that time. It's basically a snack food, and you can see it pretty much in areas that is transportation hubs or in the street corners.
And how is it eaten? If I were to see some for sale on the street and buy one, what would I do? What are the moves that I make to eat it?
Well, the typical way to eat it would be first to just tap or crack the wide part, and then one would sip or suck the juice out, which is the soup, and then you would slowly peel it until you see the egg, and then you would basically take a bite of the yolk and the embryo, and you would tend to finish it in 2 to 3 bites and not linger over it.
Are the bones of the embryo formed to the point of where they are hard, or are they still a very soft texture?
They would still be a soft texture. So 17 days, they're partially formed, and when you eat the egg, you can still somewhat say it's chewy and a little bit, I wouldn't say crunchy, but you can tell that there's bones there, the more developed the egg is.
So basically in situ in the Philippines, it's completely embraced, it's eaten by everyone, it's folded into daily life and fiesta life. What happens when it travels outside its home?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's one of these foods that has the power to conjure a landscape. At least that's my argument. You can take it anywhere, and it can be produced in Greenland, for example, if you're in Greenland, or in Italy, if you're in Italy. But when you eat it, you feel undeniably Filipino, if you're a Filipino heritage. And if you're not, and you're surrounded with Filipino friends, and you eat it, you sort of feel like you're part of being an honorary Filipino. And I think that the reason that it travels like that and becomes like that is because it's been considered such a part of the culture that it has the ability to make one go back into that particular landscape, as it were.
What's interesting about balut to me and what you touched on in one part of the book was its unmistakable, quote, authenticity, which when we talk about authenticity within food terms, it's just such a slippery word that often means nothing. But could you talk about that level of authenticity?
Well, as you know, as you mentioned, that there are foods that particularly bring out people's ire. especially when they claim this is authentic or my version is the real version. And I think where balut is particularly intriguing is that it is unapologetically itself.
Obviously, one of the aspects of balut that we have to talk about is the performative identity that comes into play. And there's so many different ones when it comes to either the diaspora community introducing it to non-Filipino Americans or non-Filipinos of whatever background they are interacting with it. Could you talk about some of that performative identity?
The reason I wrote this book was because I wanted to set the record straight. And what I mean by that is that I saw lots of people using it through the course of the last 20 years since Fear Factory first came out with balut in 2002. I saw a lot of different ways that people were using it, and there was no attempt to provide a cultural context to it. The ways that people take this food and use it in different contexts to me were interesting because, on one hand, non-Filipinos who use it in a lot of blogs, for instance, if you type balut challenge, you'll see millions of hits on videos, whether it says Australian eating balut or Italian tries balut for the first time or white American eats balut, and they'll be seen as someone who's more of an intrepid eater. And then the traditional way of eating it is usually a person, a Filipino, of Filipino heritage, who is eating it to regain a sense of Filipino-ness and to go back to the memory of being at home. So that those are just two types of performing identities that comes with eating the egg.
One of the most interesting people that you talked to for me was a woman, I believe her name is Army, who hand sold them at a farmer's market in Fremont. Can you talk about her and her relationship to balut and what kind of she feels her mission is in terms of selling them?
Army feels that balut should be tried by practically everybody. Army engages with everyone who comes to her stall because she really wants them to understand the cultural context of what is balut and not to come away into thinking that it's repulsive. So the way that she educates people into the right cultural context, I think, is key because it encourages people to try it and see it with an open eye, open eyes, and just to give it, you know, to give it a try.
It's such a fascinating book. I really just thank you for coming here and talking to us so thoughtfully about a subject that is so often just demonized and seen in this just disturbing, xenophobic way.
Yes. And I hope that I set the record straight, at least provide some kind of cultural insight, because we really need more understanding and less, as you mentioned it, less xenophobic portrayals of other people's practices.
That was independent scholar and folklorist Margaret Magat discussing her 2019 book, Balut, Fertilized Eggs and the Making of Culinary Capital in the Filipino Diaspora. Head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood, for more info about it. The egg has seen its fair share of news in the last few years. Yet even with the shortage, eggs are found on every continent and in countless cuisines. Lizzie Stark considers this versatile object in her book, Egg, A Dozen Overtures. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Evan.
What is your personal relationship with eggs and how did you become so fascinated with them?
Well, I have always been fascinated with eggs. They are the cornerstone of my relationship with my father. My father is an avid hobbyist cook. He loves cooking. It's kind of like art. It's kind of like jazz. When I was a young girl, my dad decided to do some father-daughter bonding with me. On Saturday mornings, he would give me a lesson in how to cook breakfast. And so we did a lot of eggs. And we did them in a semi-scientific fashion. I think the first experiment was to soft boil an egg properly. I came home from my swim lesson to find like 3 or 4 dozen eggs on the counter, and we boiled them for 30-second intervals to figure out the perfect soft-cooked egg consistency. Basically, we haven't stopped experimenting since.
I love that. You're so lucky to get to share that relationship. But I understand that you also have a more personal relationship with the human egg.
Yes, of course. I come from a family with a lot of cancer in it. And the cancer in my family tree is due to a genetic error on one of our BRCA1 genes. Everybody has 2 BRCA1 genes inside every cell of their body. And these genes regulate the repair of double-stranded DNA breaks inside your cells. Many people in my family, including me, are born with one of them broken. And what this does is it makes it likely that you will develop cancer over your lifetime, specifically breast and ovarian cancer. So when I was in my late 20s, I had a double mastectomy to remove my breasts and prevent breast cancer. And while I was working on this egg book, I had my ovaries out. My body is now egg-free, of human ova at least.
Were you able to have a child before you removed your ovaries?
Yes. I had a kid 5 years ago. He is a joy and a delight and in a mama phase, very much. You know, at the time I started this book, I was feeding him about 1 omelet a day. But for about the last 2 years, he's refused to eat any eggs at all, much to my dismay.
He'll come back around. He needs a break.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he doesn't even like my husband or me to eat eggs. He says, no, they're stinky. I hate them.
Yeah, well,
and I'm like,
there you
okay,
go.
fine.
So let's turn from the culinary for a minute. And if you could talk about eggs as an ancient symbol and chicken divination throughout history.
The egg is a powerful symbol. They're found, as you said in your introduction, on every continent, and they are a universally edible food. They're just kind of magical. I mean, when you think about it, one minute you have this inert stone in front of you, and then the next, there's new life coming out of it. In addition, eggs were once a more seasonal food than they are now because the reproductive cycle of birds is sensitive to light. So you end up with more eggs in the springtime, usually more eggs when there's more light outside. Because of their ubiquity, they appear in a wide range of contexts, like from the dawn of human history. I know that sounds a little grandiose, but stick with me. Ancient peoples, prehistoric peoples, used to eat ostrich eggs, and they would pour the contents of the egg out, and then they kept the shells and used the shells as canteens. An ostrich egg holds about 1 liter of water. It's got pores on the outside, which help keep the water cool. And these canteens enabled desert exploration of early humans.
That's amazing. Yeah. I asked you about chicken divination.
The ancient Romans lived by auguries. And one of the old methods of foretelling the future was to watch flocks of birds fly across the sky. And this worked pretty well, but it was inconvenient to stand around on a hill and wait for a flock of birds to come by that you could interpret. So eventually, the Romans turned to domesticated flocks of birds, and specifically chickens. There was a specialized priest called the Palearius, who was in charge of keeping the chickens. When somebody wanted to consult the birds, they would fling food out into the pen. And if the chickens ate, that was a good omen. And if the chickens didn't eat, that was a bad omen. It was also an easily manipulable omen if you were, I think, a savvy Polarius who wanted to get ahead in the world. There are other, there's a rich text of egg-based divination techniques. There's a technique for figuring out the sex of a child by dangling a raw egg on a string over a pregnant woman's belly. Livia Drusilla, a Roman empress, wanted to know whether she was going to have a baby boy or a baby girl. And so she put an egg in between her breasts and incubated it until it hatched. And it was a rooster. And she went on to give birth to a boy who could become emperor. And then there are a lot of folk medicine traditions of using eggs as a kind of sympathetic magic to draw out illness or bad spirits that are inside a person.
The world is a magical place. That's author Lizzie Stark. We've been discussing her curiosity about eggs and her new book with one of the greatest titles ever, Egg, A Dozen Overtures. If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Elena Shatkin, and to our engineers, Nick Lamponi and Hope Brush. And special thanks to Phil Richards, Laura Kondarajan, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. KCRW's annual Pie Fest is only a month away. Mark your calendars for Sunday, April 28th for a fun-filled afternoon on UCLA's Royce Quad. Bakers, we are going big on fruit pie this year and introducing 4 new categories, double crust apple, apple crumble, berry pie, and a hand pie category. All in, we have 9 categories to choose from this year, including one for kids under 12. Go to kcrw.com/pie and sign up today. I'll meet you back here next week for another episode of Good Food.